Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses the current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. Stay tuned and listen to the movers and shakers in multifamily share their opinions and thoughts about what's old, what's new, and where the multifamily industry is heading in the future. You are listening to Multifamily Matters, because multifamily matters.
Well, welcome and thank you for tuning in to Multifamily Matters, the only broadcast radio show in the nation that's solely dedicated to multifamily industry operations. I'm your host, Paul Marks. We have a great show with a wonderful guest who can certainly speak to today's topic. And today we're discussing insights on the state of the rental housing industry. Joining me today by phone is a gentleman who is truly a multifamily industry leader, Bob Pinneger, the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. Welcome, Bob.
No, thanks for having me on.
You know, we spoke a little bit before we started the recording of this episode, and we figured out that you were last on the show back in 2019, and we've had a little bit of a pandemic that's occurred in that time period. So I'm glad to have you back on, but a lot of things from that pandemic I think we're going to be discussing today that have caused some industry trends as well as challenges.
Definitely. I mean, they've accelerated some things and they've brought new challenges to us that we never knew we would ever face before.
Well, let's talk about the in what you see as the current state of the industry.
Well, I mean, you know, it is a very diverse industry with everything from the independent rental owners all the way up to the large professionally managed properties that are owned by institutional investors. And, you know, we see that going through COVID, there was a substantial financial hit for the industry. I mean, some estimates have it as high as a $73 billion in lost rent. I think that a lot of this significant impact was in the C-class and independent rental owner properties. I think A and B fared better just because of the profile of the residents that they had, and these people were able to work remote. But it has caused challenges, regardless of if you have an A product or a C product. There have been challenges that have been associated and financial losses that have been there.
Yeah, and obviously the CDC put in place the eviction moratorium, and I know we're going to talk about a little bit more in the fourth segment, but that was something that I think, from the association standpoint, was something you guys were on top of, trying to help owners in the industry.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the lobbying on the Hill with regards to rental assistance was something that we were pushing from the very beginning. Unfortunately, it took, you know, extended amount of time before those dollars finally became available. And there's other issues around distribution of funds. But then also with regards to the administration and attempting to try to get clarification once this eviction moratorium was issued, it did catch a lot of people by surprise that the order was issued the way it was. We were able to clarify some points in it to make it somewhat more workable. But ultimately, we had to resort to the courts and get the Supreme Court to strike down that ruling.
And I guess what's the outlook in the future for the for housing affordability from as a result of the moratorium and the pandemic?
I think the moratorium and the pandemic have, I think, accelerated our challenges and problems we have with housing affordability. There's studies that I've seen out there that indicated that, especially in the independent rental owners category, where you have single-family rental product, that you've seen a significant amount of product that has been sold simply because the operators couldn't afford financially to keep it going, or they were just done with it and they threw their hands up. So I think we do have, and I think that's contributing to what we're seeing with regards to rent growth around the country. I think that ultimately that independent rental owner will return, and in areas like the Sun Belt states, they will come back into the market. But if you were in the coastal markets where you tend to have much more expensive product and you ended up selling a single-family home, the amount of capital you'd have to put in for the down payment and the amount of mortgage you would pay to position yourself again probably indicates that you're not going to do it because it just simply doesn't pencil.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about some of the operational challenges that you see in the industry right now.
Well, you know, previous to COVID, recruitment of, you know, on-site staff, maintenance staff, of, you know, leasing consultants was a challenge. Through COVID, it has become increasingly so. And so definitely staffing has become a very large issue. You know, in fact, we had our annual conference in Chicago this year, and we were having a conversation with executives from around the industry, and what was their number one issue? And hiring on-site maintenance staff continues to be the most difficult position to fill, and everybody is scrambling to try to find those staff at the site level.
And then I guess other operational challenges could possibly be being more efficient and trying to figure out how to best maximize revenues. Did you talk about that?
Definitely. I mean, that has been something that, especially as we began to get into the 2018-2019, there was a lot of conversation about return to basics and operational efficiencies. I think that with the onset of the pandemic and COVID, there was a lot of operators that initially struggled in how to deal with this. I mean, ultimately, there were operators that really began to develop systems and programs about how do you decentralize maintenance across a large property and how do you have the maintenance supplies distributed, how do you deal with the time card to punch people in and punch people out. So it really forced the industry to embrace technology in a way that we really haven't before. And if you think about virtual tours and virtual leasing is something that, you know, the larger operators played with and toyed with, but really didn't get into it in a meaningful way. And overnight, this industry had to adapt and evolve, and we did. And, you know, so I think there's the efficiencies from that standpoint. And I think those lessons that we've learned from how do we adapt and change is something that will help us in the future, because, you know, there's going to be other business challenges that will face this industry. And I think if we remember the lessons of how we were able to adapt, I think we'll be more successful in the future.
You know, I've had several guests on the show during the pandemic that were talking about, and they were from different parts of the United States. They had mentioned the fact that in their area, in their regions of the country, companies, management companies, owners of multifamily properties who would typically be seeing each other as competitors kind of banded together and created these think tanks where they would have a call on a weekly basis, and they would talk about what they were doing, how they were reacting to the pandemic, how they were operating their properties. And every single person who mentioned this told me they thought it was just a brilliant way of working together within the industry. What did you hear about that during the pandemic?
No, there were a number of groups like that began to pop up around the country, and we were actually successful in being able to feed them information and resources so they could have those conversations. And if you think about it, nobody had a pandemic playbook going into COVID. And so the amount of change that had to occur in the industry, people trying to figure out what's the best way to do things, how can I adapt? I mean, having those groups that just organically appeared across the country, and largely it was regionally based because people knew their counterparts and they could trust them and have conversations. I mean, they were very successful. And, you know, we were doing everything we could to support them, because ultimately the more information we were able to get out there into the industry, the more quickly we could adapt to all the changes that were going on.
You know, and I always ask the follow-up question to the guests who brought that up, and I would say, well, since the pandemic has begun to wane and things are starting to get back to what a more normal situation would be, have you continued to have calls so that you can share ideas? And every one of them said no. So unfortunately, I wish there was a way as an industry that we could do that. Of course, NAA does that throughout the year, but in a large scale basis nationally by bringing people together. But it sure seemed like it was a big help during the pandemic.
It was a great help during the pandemic, and you know the crisis brought people together in ways they hadn't before. We've been able to, like, we're trying to deal with the situation right now with the Afghan refugees and trying to pull people together. There's been a willingness to have conversations about these things, and people have come together. So I think it's really going to depend on issue-by-issue basis. And, you know, now that we're hearing everything about this Omicron variant, my hopes is that it's not as destructive as was first indicated. You know, we may have to have those conversations again. But I think that that'll really result in what is the situation and where are we going to be in, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks from now to really adapt if we need to.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it here for this segment. We're going to be back with our second segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
Your multifamily property's water and sewer rates are skyrocketing every year. The only way to lessen the impact is to reduce water consumption through water conservation. E-Conserve has pioneered a no-cost, no-risk water conservation program, and it doesn't cost you a penny. A property in Houston is saving over $196,000 a year with this no-cost program. Call E-Conserve today at 713-662-3220. For a free analysis of your property, that's eConserve at 713-662-3220.
REV, the multifamily leasing company, is the industry's long-term affordable leasing management solution. After all, it's really not about cost. It's really all about revenues. Book REV's expert directors and leasing career professionals for your properties today. Let REV drive revenues and create significant incremental value for you. Reduce stress, stabilize and maximize leasing performance. Never expend resources to recruit or train for leasing again. Lease up, value add, conventional leasing. Let REV be your long-term leasing solution. Go to revlmc.com to find out more. That's revlmc.com. REV is revolutionizing multifamily leasing. Hire REV today.
Well, we are back, and you are listening to Multifamily Matters, and we're discussing the topic of insights on the state of the rental housing industry. I'm Paul Marks, and joining me today by phone is a real multifamily industry leader, Bob Pinneker, the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. Before we jump back into the conversation, I do want to remind our listeners, if you would like to provide show topics, guest ideas, suggestions, or listen to any archived episode of Multifamily Matters, please go to our website at multifamilyradio.com. Bob, we just briefly touched in the first segment on housing affordability and the result of some of the issues caused from the eviction moratorium and the pandemic. Let's talk a little bit about more about that. What has NAA been doing about trying to get on top of that challenge?
Well, yeah, we've been trying to work through Congress on a number of issues. I mean, Section 8 reform is definitely been one that we've been working on for years, attempting to try to get some better policies in that area. I mean, this is a program that was designed in the late 60s, early 70s, and this industry has evolved so much since that point in time, but the program that was created largely is based upon the assumptions of the industry, 30, 40 years ago. And so that's something we've been working as diligently as we can to try to get that done. We're also, you know, it's funny because we talk about supply chain issues. That is the topic that is we've been talking about throughout the pandemic. And if you stop and think about it, the nation's housing affordability crisis is really because of the supply chain issues of the lack of available housing, available land on which to build housing. And so we're looking at what happens over a long period of time without having enough land that is zoned and that is affordable to really create more housing that is needed. And we're working on the Yes in My Backyard legislation or the YIMBY Act. Or there's another piece of legislation, Build More Housing Near Transit and Promoting Affordable Housing Near Transit Act. And those are efforts we're working at in addition to Section 8, because ultimately it comes down to the availability of land and price of land. If the land is not available in an adequate supply, it's just not going to pencil to build new product. And if you think about the fact that we need to build 328,000 new apartments every year just to meet the demand going forward to keep the current imbalance, and we've only done that four times since 1989, you can really see what happens as a result of the lack of available land to build on.
And what are some of the barriers of building the affordable housing? You mentioned some of the legislation you were working on. What are some of the other barriers that you find in different marketplaces?
Different marketplaces have, California, for example, has huge environmental regulations that slow down the process and create a bunch of uncertainty. And people go into the courts all the time to stop or slow down projects. And so as a result, and if you look at California and the housing affordability crisis they have in that state, it's directly related to some of those processes. We had a research project that we did in 2017, and we went back and expanded it and updated it in 2018, 2019. And we looked at over 50 different metropolitan areas around the country and ranked them and look at what were the barriers to housing. And really it's this not in my backyard effort, which has morphed itself through limiting the more land being made available, through putting increasing regulations, increasing costs for new development. They treat a multifamily as though it's single family, when in reality, multifamily housing is much more efficient use of space. It's a much more efficient use of resources, of utilities for the local jurisdictions. And these are things that we battle all the time, whether it is in Washington, D.C., or at the state capitals, or in city councils all across the country through NAA and its affiliate network.
And you talked a little bit about some of the legislation that's currently out there. Is there anything that you see on a statewide or local level that needs to be addressed and that you guys are working on?
Well, we're very concerned about what happened in St. Paul and Minneapolis. For those of your viewers or listeners that may not be aware, there were two rent control initiatives that were put on the ballot this year in St. Paul and in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, it was more of a question about rent control and allowing the council to set policies. In St. Paul, they implemented a rent cap, a 3% increase per year on all rental housing, on even new rental housing. So essentially what they've done is they have driven away the developers, because the numbers just don't make sense to pencil to build product, looking at some of the restrictions they put on. In fact, it was described as the most restrictive rent control policy in the world by many of the media that looked at it. Rent control is not the answer. It never has been the answer. If you look at cities with longstanding rent control policies, Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, they have some of the least affordable housing in the country as a result of the policies that they've implemented around housing. And so what we really want to work on is, how do we come up with policies that allow for there to be investment to create more housing, to create a situation to where the property owner and the residents win, because these one-sided, where one group wins and the other group loses, of policies are not successful in the long term. They're not sustainable, and they're going to damage the quality of the nation's rental housing stock if we don't come to solutions very quickly.
We've got about 4 minutes left in this segment. Can you speak to, in a perfect world, what the answer might be for the affordability issue?
Well, I think that we would, in a perfect world, it's really having a conversation and looking at what are the resources that are out there that are available for development of new rental housing. This is land This is, setback requirements, all the different requirements that go into the building of communities. If you're in a downtown area and there's access to transportation, reducing the parking requirements goes a long way towards making the property more affordable to develop. So it's a whole series of things. And looking at where employment centers are and how do we create housing that is adjacent to those employment centers so people don't have to be in the cars driving as much. On the other side of the housing issue, it's also about economic development. And what are the state and local government's policies towards creating jobs that are substantial to be able to support the community? That's also another part of it that is not talked about a lot of times, but it's the economic strategy of the state and local governments help to drive the success of the community as well.
We've got about 2.5 minutes left in the segment. Are there any areas of the country where you see that they're doing it better or doing it right?
The Sun Belt states tend to be better positioned for creating more housing, for having more affordability. Part of that is because there's more land that is available. Part of it's also because the governments have taken an approach where they want to look at cooperative solutions with the industry. They don't have these long development timelines that the coastal markets tend to have that make it much more expensive to build. So those communities in the Sun Belt states have actually had more success than areas that have had more restrictive, less industry-friendly policies.
And are you when you're talking about the Sun Belt states, are you also referring to the major markets within those Sun Belt states, or is it in some of the smaller markets that you see?
We're in an interesting time right now because we had seen a concentration of development in urban centers pre-COVID. I think that the urban centers will come back, but I think that the suburbs are going to have a much better, more favorable footing than they did pre-COVID, where everybody wanted to be, downtown, walkable, community, all of that. I think we're going to see the suburbs begin to transform into more of an urban, suburban environment. But I think that will also help as well, because those communities, if you look at Houston's and Dallas, what they're doing in their respective markets, there's some markets to look at. If you look at Austin, they've had all kinds of challenges, and part of that's because the politics of the city council is making it more difficult to develop a new product.
Okay. All right. Well, we are going to leave it here with this segment. We're going to be back with our next segment right after these messages. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
In a world where keeping up with an ever-evolving technology landscape continues to be a challenge, Allegion helps property managers cut through the noise to supply their residents with the amenity most critical to the digital generation, mobile access control. Ideal for the multifamily market, Allegion has designed mobile-enabled solutions that streamlines access while providing the security and benefits for developers, property managers, and residents alike. To learn more about Allegion's access control product offerings, please visit usallegion.com/MFM.
Your multifamily property's water and sewer rates are skyrocketing every year. The only way to lessen the impact is to reduce water consumption through water conservation. EconServe has pioneered a no-cost, no-risk water conservation program, and it doesn't cost you a penny. A property in Houston is saving over $196,000 a year with this no-cost program. Call EconServe today at 713-662-3220. For a free analysis of your property, that's EconServe at 713-662-3220.
We're back, and you are listening to Multifamily Matters. Today, we're discussing the topic of insights on the state of the rental housing industry. I'm Paul Marks, and joining me today by phone is a gentleman who is a multifamily industry leader, Mr. Bob Penninger, the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. I do want to take a quick moment and thank our exclusive sponsors that make Multifamily Matters possible. Econserve, providing multifamily water conservation solutions for properties across the U.S. Rev, the leasing management company. Rev is revolutionizing multifamily leasing. Allegion, a leading provider of mobile-enabled products and solutions for efficient access control within multifamily properties. And CTS, Complete Technology Solutions, making managed IT an easy business decision for multifamily. Bob, let's talk a little bit in this segment about amenities and some of the challenges of the pandemic in the past 18 months that that caused not only innovation, but quicker adoption than we have seen in past years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the amenity wars of pre-COVID really focused on the physical asset itself. But through COVID, we began to see technology and, you know, having smart apps that allow the residents to be able to do things as easily as opening their phone and hitting on a few buttons, as opposed to calling somebody or, you know, having to physically go down to the leasing office. As I think I'd mentioned earlier, that online leasing became something that really blossomed during COVID, being able to come in and do videos of the available units that could then be uploaded. And so the resident didn't necessarily have to come and look at the unit. They could actually make the decision to move very quickly and easily. And when you think about during COVID, the types of searches that I was getting reports on is that people were looking, there was two types of searches. You were either looking, if you were in an urban environment, you were looking at a more suburban, outlying city or community, or there was another large segment that was just making the decision that they were going to move from one part of the country to the other. And so you began to see people searching cross-country. So there was no realistic way for them to go out and take a physical look at the property. So they made the decision completely online. And the industry's ability to adapt to that really, I think, made the difference for a lot of operators for being successful or not being successful through the pandemic.
You know, some of the, with everybody working from, not everybody, but a lot of people now working remotely, that created some challenges from the amenity standpoint that we see a lot of owners and companies responding to. What are some of those things you've seen?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I was at a conference about 3 months ago, and we were having a conversation about the whole concept of people working from home. And they were talking with, and this was a large group of operators, and asking were the, you know, the one bedrooms with a den or two bedrooms with a den, were they more desirable now? And the answer was no. While people do want to have the ability to work within their unit, they don't want to become hermits within their rental property. So I think it's breathed new life into the concept of co-working spaces, of, you know, having the printer that I can go down and access if I need to print something up, to have at least some level of social interaction with others. Because if you think about it, everybody went to work in the morning and they came home at night. They had a lot of social interaction in their work environment. Those people who are working from home now don't have that, so they're looking for other avenues for it. So I think it does indicate that the idea of co-working spaces, which had been a challenge for some operators to make financially successful, because this is something that's likely a value add and you're going to pay something extra for the access, I think that that's something that is the new frontier of amenities for this industry.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've even had some guests that have talked about in those co-working spaces dedicating areas that are, you know, where they maybe make them a little bit more soundproof and they install some special lighting. So if someone has to work remotely and do a Zoom call, they can reserve that space to be able to do it. And they've got a green screen background built in where they can put up whatever they want to put up. And we've had quite a few people talk about that. Some of the things they're seeing coming out in the future. Have you noticed that?
No, definitely. I mean, it even myself in trying to deal with the situations of trying to do meetings virtually. I mean, having the green screen, having all of those amenities, those are things that are going to be important, especially as we begin to see people return to work throughout the entirety of the country. I think we're going to have some level of flexible schedules that is going to be with us post-COVID, and ultimately will give us the ability to rethink office space and what do we need versus what do we currently have. So there's a lot of things there that I think will position properties that embrace this and be able to make those sort of adaptations to become successful, because they'll have an advantage over the neighboring properties that don't. I mean, but also some of the other things was touchless products became very important because people didn't want to touch the door handle. They didn't want to touch the faucet. And so you began to see that occur in the common areas of the amenities. And I think that's something we're only going to see continue going forward. I mean, these were all trends before COVID, but I think that the pandemic and COVID have accelerated them much more than they ever would have been if we had not had this this situation.
Have you seen any research or anything out there that points towards the demographic of the actual resident that puts more value on those types of technologies?
You know, we have. It's interesting. We're going through the process now where the millennials are beginning to get to the point where they're purchasing their homes and they're having families, they're getting married, so they're beginning to move out of rental housing. We saw this through COVID. We saw this with the rapid increase in home values this last summer, and so we have Gen Zs coming in, and Gen Z has specific things that they're more interested in than the millennials that were before them. I mean, they do value the suburbs. They want proximity to the cities. They want to have vibrant experience. But they also want to have their space. It's kind of interesting. In many ways, they're returning to some of the attitudes and views of generations before them. And so, guaranteed parking is a big issue. Larger properties, locations to where they want to not only live but also socialize and work. So, we're seeing that with desires for different types of floor plans, different types of amenities in the common areas. So we are seeing that Gen Z is making an impact on the industry, and as we do with every generation, the properties will adapt to accommodate their desires.
Yeah, and what's interesting, we actually did an episode recently on how to market to and approach Gen Z, and the guest we had on mentioned the fact that the oldest member of the Gen Z generation is today 24 years old. So there's a huge group that's coming behind them that have never done some of the things that someone like myself, who is old and remembers the times when you wanted to look for an apartment, you went and got a leaflet at the grocery store. Everybody's doing things today, completely differently, and the Gen Zs are going to do it differently than the Gen Xs and the millennials. I want to ask you, though, about package technology. I know going to the lot to Apartmentalize in Chicago and to Optech in Washington, D.C. recently, that's a huge – there's company after company out there talking about package technology. What have you found about that? We've got about 2 minutes left.
I mean, yeah, the crushing amount of packages that are arriving in apartment buildings just as a result of the way we live now is something that continues to be there. So having the lockers that are available is very important. I've seen some operators where they've devoted entire rooms to where the packages will come in, they're put in different cubbies, it's monitored by video. Somebody has a key access code they're given when they get a message they have a package, and they come in and they grab their package, but also their video. So if they grab somebody else's package, that can be monitored as well. All those things we're going to see more and more of, especially, where it used to be it was a package that arrived. Now with groceries coming, refrigerated storage is becoming another issue that is something that is quite desirable in the eyes of residents. And the operators that adapt to these things are going to be more successful in the long run.
You know, and I want to say that this all goes back to, and you may have a different basis for it than I do, but I can remember seeing national news stories. I think it was about 2014, it seems like, when Camden were the first major company to bring this to the attention that they can't continue to accept packages. And of course, since that time, we have, and even including the pandemic, the nation has just completely gone to online deliveries, online shopping, and deliveries. It's something that 20 years ago, no one ever even thought of.
No, it's true. I mean, as you said, the days when we'd go down to the grocery store and pick up the paper magazines and go through and try to find the apartment that we were going to live in, everything has changed.
Sure.
Retail has changed, and as a result of that, we need to address not only the package delivery and storage, but also disposal of the cardboard and the packaging are other issues that need to be dealt with from a logistics standpoint, especially in older properties that were never designed for this.
Sure.
Because it was never envisioned.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to break it here, and we are going to be back with our final segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters after this short break. You're listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
In a world where keeping up with an ever-evolving technology landscape continues to be a challenge, Allegion helps property managers cut through the noise to supply their residents with the amenity most critical to the digital generation, mobile access control. Ideal for the multifamily market, Allegion has designed mobile-enabled solutions that streamlines access while providing the security and benefits for developers, property managers, and residents alike. To learn more about Allegion's access control product offerings, please visit usallegion.com/MFM.
Do you have multiple multifamily properties in your portfolio? Take control of your unpredictable IT spending with our managed IT services. Whether you have 5 or 500 properties, CTS has you covered with 24/7 nationwide remote and on-site support. Our pricing allows you to budget IT costs year after year with a predictable flat monthly rate. CTS provides the expertise, management, support, and tech infrastructure for all your properties. Call 888-255-9715 or visit ctsglobaltech.com for a free quote.
REV, the multifamily leasing company, is the industry's long-term affordable leasing management solution. After all, it's really not about cost. It's really all about revenues. Book REV's expert directors and leasing career professionals for your properties today. Let REV drive revenues and create significant incremental value for you. Reduce stress, stabilize and maximize leasing performance. Never expend resources to recruit or train for leasing again. Lease up, value add, conventional leasing. Let REV be your long-term leasing solution. Go to revlmc.com to find out more. That's revlmc.com. REV is revolutionizing multifamily leasing. Hire REV today.
Well, we are back with our final segment of this episode of Multifamily Matters, and we're discussing the topic of insights on the state of the rental housing industry. I'm Paul Marks, and joining me today by phone is a gentleman who is truly a multifamily industry leader, and he plays an important role in our industry, Bob Pinneger, the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. Bob, let's talk a little bit about rental assistance and the lawsuit that NAA has out there. And just one personal note on the rental assistance. I have seen stories in my market, which is Houston, Texas, and some other national reports where people are just having the most difficult time, it seems, in getting the money, owners meaning getting the money from the state or whoever is administering that program. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing.
Well, you know, you couldn't design a worse program for getting money out in an efficient fashion. It's if you think about it, the monies were distributed to states and to large metropolitan areas. So we have hundreds of programs out there, and the federal government didn't provide clear guidelines and in keeping with the intent of Congress. And so as a result, we have a mess. And I think part of this was as a result of the highly publicized abuses of unemployment benefits that were one of the, some of the earlier assistance programs that were pushed out. And so they then became so conservative in how they approached documentation that it's made it almost impossible for some parts of the country to get dollars out. I mean, since the beginning, we've pushed for the Treasury Department to issue mandates and not guidelines, so that way they take more control of the process and what's happening. But unfortunately, that's not happened. There was, at this point in time, for those that are behind on rent, 64% of that renter population that's behind on rent has yet to apply for rental assistance. And only 16% of those that have applied have received assistance they applied for, and 50% are still waiting for a response. And part of this is because of the confusion that has been created. And, you know, there's two tranches of money. We have emergency rental assistance 1 and emergency rental assistance 2, whereas ERA 1 was really targeted more towards back rent. ERA 2 is more current rent. There's different regulations that Congress has put down for each of those tranches, which can further confuses it as we're trying to work with the administration to simplify this process. The other thing is that ERA 1, which was the first tranche of dollars, those dollars are now at a point in time where the Treasury can redeploy and redirect those dollars from non-performing programs to higher performing programs. But if you happen to be in an area where you have a low-performance program and you're a property owner or a resident, taking those monies away is not going to help you. The system needs to be fixed. It needs to be streamlined. And, you know, if we ever have a crisis like this again, this is not the way money should be allocated. But then even on top of the $46.5 billion that was allocated by Congress, based upon estimates that we've seen from the industry, we're more talking about $73.3 billion. So there's an unfunded part of this rent debt that even if we had a highly efficient program that was running, there's simply not enough dollars to make everybody whole. And that hurts renters because they're going to have rent debt that will follow them for years, damage their credit and their ability to, you know, get a car, to buy a home, to rent an apartment. But then also it hurts property owners who are left holding the bag, and how do they make ends meet to be able to be successful going forward? And it doesn't matter if you are a large operator that is, you know, across the country, or if you're an independent owner that has just a few units, everybody has had losses. And so those are some of the challenges that we've been dealing with the assistance programs.
Have you noticed in all this time that there are some areas of the country, some states or municipalities who are administering these funds that are doing a good job of it, or is it difficult to find someone like that?
There have been groups that you can say are really stand out. I mean, I know that in the Houston area, there was a combining of the various programs and dollars to make things at least less confusing, because, you know, depending upon what side of the street you live on, across the country, you may be in one program or another. Earlier on, Colorado was a good program. We saw an efficient use of the dollars, but then things began to slow down there. Virginia is actually a program where is a standout, because while initially the program was not designed well, they they sat down with the industry and were able to come up with a program that is much more efficient, much more effective, that looks at back rent, current rent, and future rent. So they created a package that also allows the property owner to be able to check and see what the status of the processing of the payment is, what are the pain points. I mean, we've had operators that have set up computer labs in their common areas to be able to assist residents to access the funds. Because if you think about it, especially for people that are at the lower end of the economic spectrum, they don't have access to computers and scanners. They have their mobile phone. They may have a landline. But most of these programs were designed for somebody who has all of those amenities, you know, that has the high-speed internet, that has the laptop or the desktop, that has the scanner, that has the printer. And the programs need to be adjusted to be able to allow for people of various economic levels to access the program. And then the other side of this is, you know, the government put $46.5 billion into a program but didn't put any money into public information to get the word out to people that they understand that they can apply. I mean, we as the industry have worked to try to bridge that gap, but still we need the public information programs to be able to let people understand that they can apply for these dollars. They are eligible for the dollars, because in the end, if the resident walks away from the situation they're in, if they opt not to apply for rental assistance and you have to go through a process of removing them from the unit, property owners are not going to get anything because they're not going to be eligible for these federal dollars as the program currently stands.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes left before I want to transition to something else with you, but let's talk briefly about the lawsuit. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, what we ended up doing, you know, there was the lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court struck down the CDC order, which helped, we think, from a legal standpoint, our standing. What we've done is we've sued in federal court on behalf of the industry, and we're assembling plaintiffs to seek damages. So if you lost money as a result of the eviction moratorium and your residents have not applied or have moved out and you can't apply for the funding, we have this lawsuit that we've set up to be able to allow people to participate in this lawsuit. And the lawsuit is going to do two things. First of all, it's going to make those plaintiffs that join the lawsuit whole, is our intent. But then also, if Congress still has the ability to establish eviction moratoriums, and so a willing Congress and a willing president could impose something like this on the industry again. What we're attempting to do with this lawsuit is to link the regulatory taking of an eviction moratorium with the just compensation. And we're hopeful that this Supreme Court will see it the way we do. And so going forward, if this ever happened again, Congress would be required to pay people for what they were taking from them. And in this case, it would be the ability to be able to operate your business normally and be able to collect rents and be able to maintain the property and maintain the environment for the resident safety. So that's what we're trying to do with this lawsuit.
Well, it sounds to me like NA is really on top of what's happening, and as an industry, we're all thankful for that. Let's talk a little bit. I want to transition for a second into, tell us a little bit about what's going on in the future with NAA. I mean, you had the first in-person apartmentalize since the pandemic, which seemed, I was there, and it seemed to be great, successful, and some wonderful sessions and insightful sessions. And I know the next apartmentalize will be in June in San Diego, but talk a little bit about that and what you see happening maybe different as we hopefully get further away from the pandemic.
Yeah, there's an incredible desire across the industry for people to get back together. And, you know, that was really the drive for having our meeting in Chicago and trying to get back as quickly as we possibly could to in-person meetings. I can't tell you how many people I spoke with that said the energy they got from being together was something that they didn't really understand how important that was pre-COVID. So we're ramping up for Partmentalize in San Diego. It's going to be June 22nd and 24th, 2022. We're going to have all the, we're planning on having Maintenance Mania back and all the usual things that you experience with Partmentalize, including all the different activities in and around the convention center as well as downtown. And the nice thing about San Diego is everything is so close, people can just walk from one place to the other. So that we're ramping up for and we think is going to be very successful. But even before that, another event that we're preparing for is that is our Advocate event in Washington, D.C., because in March of every year, we usually bring 600 or 700 people in to go to the Hill and lobby for various issues. In 2019, they literally locked the doors behind us because we were there as COVID was breaking across the country. We had a virtual Advocate last year, but we're anticipating going back to in-person meetings with members of Congress. And given all the things we're dealing with related to COVID, related to housing affordability, related to supply chain issues, it's going to be more important than ever that the industry comes together to make their voice heard in Washington.
We've got about 30 seconds left. Talk a little bit about educational opportunities for people in the industry.
All of our education designations, CAM, CAMT, the CAPS programs, all those programs are up and running. We're pushing them out through our affiliate network as well as online resources through our Visto platform. And what we found during the pandemic is we had a record number of people that used online education to keep themselves current with what was happening in the industry. And so we anticipate that will continue to be a trend.
All right. Well, we are going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Bob, thank you so much. We always welcome you on the show at any time. You always bring the receipts and talk about what's going on and the part that NAA plays in the industry. But we are going to be back next week with another great topic and power panel of industry experts. You've been listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.
Thank you for listening to Multifamily Matters, a weekly radio show that discusses current topics and trends in the multifamily industry. To find out more about the show or make suggestions for topics or interesting guests, go to multifamilyradio.com. You have been listening to Multifamily Matters because multifamily matters.